9:05, the time, a Thursday edition of the Mornings with Ed Show. Welcome to the program. We've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. We've been covering this topic since before it got started. On February 24th, the world witnessed more than a border conflict and more than the start of an incursion, much more than those things. The barbaric assault on a sovereign nation for the world to see has turned into an attempt of an entire civilized nation to stand up and defend their very existence. Ukraine is now in the fourth month of the only chance it will ever get to protect that sovereignty. And as we watch from here, we have only questions. Brigadier General Peter Zwack writes as a Wilson Center Global Fellow at the Kennan Institute. He started his 34-year U.S. Army career as an intelligence and security officer in a nuclear-capable artillery battalion. 3 decades later, he served as the U.S. Senior Defense Attaché to the Russian Federation between the periods of 2012 to 2014. And to join us for the conversation this morning and answer a lot of the questions we have is Brigadier General Peter Zwack. Thank you, Brigadier General, for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Ed, for having me, and good morning to your listeners.
Thank you very much, sir. A wide range of topics to discover this morning, or to talk about this morning, as we discover that 20% of Ukraine is now under Russian control, according to President Zelensky this morning. I want to start with your trip to Turkey. You just got back from Turkey, and I can't help but think that part of the reason you went was to help convince them to be a more cooperative NATO partner. Was that the case?
I was there with a group of think tankers and academics for a security conference. The topic was Middle East, but also about Russia, Ukraine. Coming to a consensus on the nature of the invasion in Ukraine and what's going on. And of course, Turkey, a country in many ways also in between. It is a country that has huge equities on the Black Sea in the region. It is a NATO ally, and I've worked with two Turkish troops in both Afghanistan and in the Balkans, and they were good to work with. Yet they also have their own interests that aren't just the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and Europe, but also, if you will, the extended Middle East, the Black Sea, which means Ukraine and the Caucasus. So there's a lot going on in Turkey. The main issue for the Turks at the time is, as you've known and your listeners, that they've been in and out of a nasty, if you will, fight with Kurdish, if you will, fighters fighting for what they believe are their equities in eastern Turkey. This is all playing out in Syria. Yet Turkey is a valued ally of ours, and it's finding the balance of what's going on. And then, of course, everybody read a few weeks ago that the Finns and the Swedes want to come into NATO. They've just laid in the paperwork for that. And the Turks are making it difficult. They're making a point. My belief is they're going to make their point and then ultimately agree as good alliance members. But it, of course, it creates anxious moments for the alliance. In the background is Russia, which also has time immemorial been fighting the Turks and the Ottomans. But they share the Black Sea, interest in the Caucasus, and the Turks, while allies, also did not want to put sanctions on Russia. They are their own equities, and they want to maintain aspects of business with Russia as well. So there is a lot going on right now. There will be a NATO summit. You know, President Biden is meeting with the NATO Secretary General, I believe, today in Washington. And then you have the very important Madrid summit, the big annual NATO summit later this month. I think a lot of this stuff is going to be worked out. The most important thing is what we all saw, this remarkable pull together of NATO cohesion, which we worried about somewhat in the face, as you said, Ed, This is of an invasion of the type that we haven't seen since Poland was invaded in 1939. By Hitler and Stalin. I think I'll start with that and go back to you.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And I do want to come back to Turkey and whether or not we can trust that President Erdogan is all in with NATO and their goals or not. I do want to come back to that. But we found out yesterday that senior administration officials confirmed that the U.S. is in fact going to send to the Ukraine U.S.-made high-mobility artillery rocket systems as part of one of our packages and security assistance. I think my question is this delivery about 90 days late?
You know, it's a great question. You know, I'm in that mind where, because I get asked variations of that on numerous things, I would ask that folks... we are where we are, and we were. And the circumstances have changed, and we have the benefit of hindsight, but we are where we are now. And, I think you go back and we could certainly, Monday morning quarterback ourselves on that and air and all that. Bottom line, the Ukrainians, here's, I think, a main point. Remarkably, looks like Ukraine... Certainly, when we looked at it 3 months ago, Ukraine is going to exist as an independent nation. That's remarkable. And in large part was the Ukrainian moxie and will to fight and skill that the Russians completely underestimated in their own arrogance and disdain to the Turks. You have that. Yes. And they got weapons. They've got a lot of stingers and different things that came on that and javelins that really really helped. But the bigger systems, folks were worried and careful about, insofar as didn't know where this was going to go in the first 6 weeks to 2 months, and so they were careful. Though a lot was provided, now we are where we are right now. The Ukrainians, I believe, will survive as a nation, but they are under heavy, heavy duress in the Donbass, eastern Ukraine, where you are getting basically a World War I-style, artillery-backed Verdun battle where the Russians are just trying to grind them down, where they finally could fix, if you will, locate the Ukrainians who have been out in the wider areas very skillful and nimble, but here they've got them fixed. They're bringing in masses of artillery. Yes, we wish there were more systems and more capable systems. That's now being worked. But I do worry in the near term about this grinded out fight where both sides are suffering terrible losses. And what will happen? Will the Russians actually gain and secure Ukraine based on this fight? Will the Ukrainians have the means to counterattack if they plan to do? And then in the south, you have a whole nother fight where major chunks of Ukraine since 2014, and I was in Moscow for the first invasion. In the spring of 2014, but since then, a lot of land along the what they call the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea, almost up to the important port city of Odessa, has been taken by the Russians. And the Ukrainians want to push them out. They're planning to push them out, and they're going to need more and better systems to do that. So, Ed, it's going to play out. This is going to take time. Yes, it may be belated. But again, we are where we are, where we were, and now are now, and we're just going to have to see. But I think this is going to be heavily discussed in NATO. What does worry me is the West, including our own nation, getting fatigue, meaning the economy and inflation and all the things you're reading about, and there's a great worry about humanitarian food crisis that's going to come with that. All of that is going to play, and I kind of worry that there will be pressure on the Ukrainians to agree to a ceasefire that the Russians might float. And if they do, and this is important, that ceasefire would be probably roughly on the lines where the Russians are now, or what they've conquered. And if you get that, you get a freeze, almost like an armistice, and now you have the roots for another conflict, or the Russians have gained. They have won somewhat since this absolutely, and you said it so well, just absolutely horrific, unprovoked invasion that we all witnessed 100 days ago.
Right. I think the concern, and I mentioned this earlier this morning on the program, that a possible negotiated peace would end up essentially making Ukraine into a Korea from, you know, a modern day Korea, and how that peninsula was split.
Yeah, my feeling on this is, as long as the Ukrainians want to fight for their soil, meaning counterattack, we, West, but like-minded nations, need to support them as best in any way we can, realistically understanding, the limits of that support, and the main limit is does Ukraine take the war to inside Russia that now opens up a Frankenstein monster of possibilities. But no, Ukrainians had need to be able to fight for their country, and any decision on ceasefires has to go through President Zelensky and Kyiv, and not just a, if you will, consortium of concerned issues, countries that just want the fighting to stop for many justifiable reasons.
You talked about the short attention span that we have when it involves something like this, if it doesn't directly involve us here in the United States. I want to talk to you about military strategy this way for a second. So the systems that we're sending to Ukraine will be equipped with munitions that allow the Ukrainians to launch rockets about 45 to 50 miles. And that's far less than a lot of the systems' maximum range that we could be offering, but greater than what they have right now. Strategically, though, wouldn't it be advantageous to make them more dangerous with longer range systems that could actually reach Russia? And I know you said about building a Frankenstein monster, but wouldn't it provoke a little more fear in Russia?
I there are two aspects of this. One, yeah, there's fear in those border regions. But there's also even more anger, and if you have populations that are wavering, they harden. And I believe there are two major existential fights, and maybe three fights right now ongoing for Ukraine. One is the existence of Ukraine as an independent, free, vibrant nation. Yeah, it's got issues to work, but free, and that is that. That has been I think winning in that context, as gruesome it is. The other fight, and this is a longer one, and is the perception and the support of the Russian people for the Putin regime and this awful war. And finding the way to balance it in such a way where there is continued Russian, if you will, population concern and anger and irritation and worry about it, that if the Ukrainians were to rain a bunch of firepower in there, in the end may create all kinds of Russian reactions that could escalate it even more, and you know what I'm implying about. There's right. always this specter of tactical nukes or chemical. I think the Russians don't want to go that way, but if they feel existentially threatened or really backed against the wall, or anything is possible. So I'm all for these very lethal, very capable HIMARS systems, going to reach out 50 miles with great precision. With multiple rockets, and that will do well in the counter battery fight with a lot of the Russian artillery that is there. I'm wary on lots of stuff that can go range deep into Russia because they're gonna use it, and I don't know which way. I don't think it'll change the war, but it may change the nature of it. And this is already a pretty awful conflict.
Thank you. Thank you for that reply. If anyone in the world has their finger on the pulse of the inner workings of Russian government, it is you. So is there any chance that a group of Russian generals or someone within the Kremlin but not Putin would risk taking control and overthrowing Putin if this war is extended months and maybe even years?
Anything is possible. I'm very careful about discussions regarding what we call regime change and color revolution. The bottom line is that you have a number of what they call Filovki, Russian power center people around Putin, oligarchs, business people, and you have military. They're patriots. They're Russians, real, but also historically, or because of the nature of a court like that that is somewhat Byzantine, they're also opportunists, but they're also survivors, Ed. And they're sniffing the tea leaves and watching the population. Population has been cowed, would be the word I use right now in the near term. But that doesn't mean that they're watching and simmering below the surface, good chunks of that. And, if the regime were to go crazy on a nuclear thing or something like that, I will say this. Anything is possible, though right now the regime is hyper-sensitive, hyper-paranoid about threats from within. And this is the type of thing that would likely generate. We wouldn't see it coming. And I believe any discussion like this is something, this is for the Russians to work out. And we need to be careful about talking from our side about the regime subverting itself, because in many ways that feeds into the paranoid threat assessment that Putin and others may have that may make them even more in that cornered rat type of, perception. So my long answer is it's possible. It's something for the Russians to determine. They've had intrigues in their court, whether in the Romanov time, in the Soviet times, time immemorial. The regime is under stress. Putin is under amazing stress, whether he is sick or not. And this isn't playing well in River City, if you will, for the Russians, though they have somewhat their balance after the fiasco that hit their military outside of the capital city of Kyiv. One other point, we're talking about Putin. I want to mention one thing about Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukrainian president, and it gets into all this, power and people. If there's any single person in the world that makes Vladimir Putin seethe, just vibrate, of this former comedian talk show who became a sort of an uncertain president that looked him in the eye the first 96 hours of the invasion, when we all thought and were encouraging him to leave Kyiv, he stood there in Kyiv. The Russians are on that were coming in, and he looks into Russia, if you will, proverbial, and says, "Blank you, I'm staying here." And that gesture of leadership, Ukrainians were going to fight, but they pulled them together, and this is a leadership thing that Putin didn't see, didn't get, and it has absolutely plagued his forces, and I think embarrasses him as a leader when you have this man, this sort of anti-Putin capture his people and the world, and probably captured a number of Russians as well.
Yeah, we have absolutely been astonished at the fortitude, not just of the Ukrainian people, but of their president, Volodymyr Zelensky, the amazing fortitude that he's shown. And you mentioned the capital, and the smart money in the world was thinking it would take days, maybe even weeks, to overthrow the Capitol, and that never happened. Russia got backed off the Capitol. And yesterday, the Russian foreign minister said that Ukraine's demand for advanced rockets is a direct provocation. Militarily, what's your assessment of the strength and competence of the Russian military after witnessing these last 4 months?
I've been studying and paying attention to the Russian military a long time, and I saw them in person a lot between 2012 and 2014 when I served as our defense attaché in Moscow, and that included the first invasion. And then I was in Moscow speaking at a conference just 11 months ago. And it was a multinational conference about security, and met a number of them, including international military. And we knew they had their aspects that, you know, since the very clumsy victory in Georgia in 2008, and then the invasion, the first one in 2014, where they were very clever in grabbing and annexing Crimea, but in a very ugly fight in the first fight for eastern Ukraine, which I kind of call it equivalent to Northern Ireland on steroids. But we thought that, and then they went into Syria, if you remember, in 2015, and actually did a pretty good job in preserving President Assad and that regime when they were on life support. And I think that, but these were small operations, Ed. And I think that a number of analysts kind of looked at that and then magnified it, that the whole Russian military is improving. And it was in fits and starts. But still, this is a military that's probably one-third conscript draftees. And they've got issues and corruption issues and haven't trained. They have these huge exercises, but they haven't trained their military in what you call, you know, frontal operations over a 800-1,000 mile front, like not since World War II. And you saw how their logistics, their supplies, bringing forces in from all over their empire, but lousy command and control. They didn't even have a number one military leader directing it the first 6 weeks until they realized they needed to get more organization. They have learned a lot, but you can't fix major problems, and we know this in business, in 2 weeks or 6 weeks and 4 weeks, especially when you're bringing troops up and training them, and a lot of second stringers are now coming in because a lot of the first stringers got battered in the first few weeks. So the Russians are better. They're in their fight now. On eastern Ukraine, that Donbass, this is what the Russians do. They do artillery. They do mass firepower. They have fixed. They've got almost the Ukrainians on that 50-mile front by that city you're all hearing about, Severodonetsk, in a bear hug, where they now have locked in Ukrainian forces that are in trench lines and fighting. And now they've got the positions and raining in artillery. And that's where we come back to the early discussion. Yes, we wish we had bigger, longer, better artillery systems, but we are where we are right now. And this is going to be a very difficult fight for the Ukrainians in the next few weeks. It's going to be an anxious summer. We'll have to see what happens in the south. As long as they're hanging on in Donetsk in the east, that doesn't allow the Russians to shift reinforcements down into the south, where the Ukrainians are making counterattacks right now. So it's still very much a big war. It's complex, and we don't know how long it is. And this is the big question. Is this turning into a long war? What does that mean? And Ed, we talked about it. How does that affect European and our society and now the global economy? And that's going to be huge. And then what is going to be the end state? And again, and the end state is it do the Ukrainians fight all the way back and get all their country back in 2014, which would probably be really hard, as we're seeing, even if a major arm. Two, do they agree to a ceasefire? But what does that look like? And that could mean a lot of lands lost and premature. Or we let them fight back to as far as they think they can fight And then maybe that ceasefire comes on the 2014 lines or something like that. We don't know. It's a Ukrainian Zelensky choice first, and then hopefully we can encourage and all of that. But the whole world's got to continue to support this free-minded nation that it's fighting for its life, but just may have succeeded. And we all did help with that. We shouldn't forget that.
Well, as part of that support, of course, what we're sending over is the Javelin anti-tank weapons, anti-armor weapons, artillery rounds, helicopters, and tactical vehicles. What, for this long battle, or this long entrenched battle, what don't they have that would be a game changer? What's on their wish list that they're not getting?
Yeah. Game changers, I think, game changers as far as a single weapon system, certainly. Recognition. More range artillery and counter artillery radars, and that's happening. It's been slow. A lot of stuff did go in last month, but these multiple rocket launchers being part of a new group. I think now, you know, whatever you can do to support, you know, the Ukrainian Air Force with better more platforms. Of the type they already have. And I think the more Stinger, Javelins, and the Europeans, the Germans, and the Brits have excellent systems and laws, all that stuff that still, in the end, knocks out enemy tanks, those drones, those Turkish drones. Here's the paradox of the Turks. They've been, there's an aspect of them where they do business with Russia. But those Turkish TB2 Bayraktar drones have been hell on Russian armor that they have provided to the Ukrainians. So the Turks are in a careful balancing thing. And more, just lots and more of it. I think maybe the X factor, the key point, we talk big level leadership, is the Ukrainians, it's hard, and they're suffering losses, and there's some ranks are wavering, but it's not because they don't believe in being Ukrainian or their will to fight. The Russian forces, as long as they're fighting on ill-begotten land, especially in the last 3 months, a lot of those troops, and you've read about it, don't want to be there. They want to come home. They don't want to. It's become a nasty fight. And because it's on Ukrainian soil, something we've been reading about is arising now, and it kind of mirrors what happened when the Nazis invaded these exact lands in World War II, is now there is a growing Ukrainian partisan fight. And partisan fights are nasty because there is the fight to knock off Russians and their proxies, and then the Russian for heavy-handed operations in villages and towns trying to crush local freedom fighters. And what is interesting on the Russian side that I think just inflames the Ukrainians when you hear of them putting in foreign fighters like Syrians or Chechens, or their press ganging almost forces, Russian quasi forces, proxy forces from Lugansk and Donetsk, which is most of eastern Ukraine, putting them in the units and throwing them in many ways like cannon fodder in that area. They get the Ukrainian positions to reveal itself. Then Russian artillery hits them, and then the better Russian troops follow. So this is a nasty, bloody conflict. And when you hear estimates of 50, 100 killed a day just on the Ukrainian side in this front, can't imagine how big it is. But a lot of this now is will to fight and spirit to fight. And again, the Russians are the invaders. They are, and the nickname, by the way, that the Ukrainian military call the Russian military, call them orcs, just to give you some of the symbology of this fight.
Okay. I want to talk about lessons that we've learned from the buildup and then the eventual invasion back in February and how we see the world in the next 5 years. Is this a warm-up for a late reaction that we might have in Taiwan? And if you were the other side, would you risk Taiwan at this point?
Here's a perspective on the People's Republic of China, and it's a great question. If I'm Xi Jinping, who, as we remember, Vladimir Putin met on the 8th of February, less than 4 months ago, in Beijing, on the margins of the Beijing Olympics. And I don't know, nobody knows what was said, but I'm sure Putin told Xi Jinping a variation that we're planning to go, meaning Ukraine, no details or anything like that. Xi Jinping, and it's my imagination, would probably say, we support you. That doesn't mean militarily. Don't get into trouble. My Olympics. And then as we saw literally 10 days after, 2 weeks afterwards, the invasion went in. If I'm the Chinese, yes, I appreciate the disruption in the West and all that, but I'm actually horrified. My strategic partner, that doesn't mean military ally, though they've done some military, has shown itself in the last 3 months, especially the first month, to have clay feet. Right. And this isn't such a reliable partner, militarily, certainly, that we thought. And so for the end, oh, by the way, what did Putin do? He just stirred up what I call not just the democratic world, but the free-minded world, the like-minded world, a good chunk of which is also in the Asia-Pacific, which now, if Xi Jinping wants to launch on an adventure into Taiwan, he sees a West, certainly, and other portions more pulled together, if you will, in an anti-autocratic view. And yes, he may extrapolate, he may take, well, we didn't go in all the way to fight on the ground with Ukraine, but we gave him a lot of support, a lot of money and all of that. And some variation of that, I'm sure, it would happen regarding Taiwan. So it's now, and the last thing it's made very hard for Xi Jinping, and who wants Russia to succeed up to a point. They want him to succeed, but it's bad for the Chinese brand to support a Russian partner who's got now blood and war crimes on their hands. And so China has to be careful in how they support this. But what it has done is woken up the world, energized the world. It has also got the world focused on economics, which is a big deal for China. And all of this could play into future chapters in the Asia Pacific. To make a long story short, the Ukraine invasion by Russia woken up major chunks of the world, including Xi Jinping's, in his mind, Asia Pacific, and he has to think twice about aggression. Oh, by the way, the Taiwanese, they don't want to fight with China, see themselves as Taiwanese. Nobody over years old remembers being part of a unified China, and they'll fight, and it'll be a hard fight, and there'll be support, and we'll just have to see how it plays out. Did that help?
That helped, and I certainly appreciate that. Thank you for that answer. You'll be speaking at the World Affairs Council of Orange County on Wednesday the 8th. It's a reception that starts at 5:30 at the Pacific Club in Newport Beach. I can't thank you enough for the sobering conversation. Brigadier General Peter Zwack, served as the U.S. Senior Defense Attaché to the Russian Federation. We thank you so much for your time with us today, General.
Had a real honor, and sometime I look forward to having a drink with you.
I look forward to sitting down and having a drink in that conversation as well. Thank you again, General Zwack.
Cheers, and God bless to your audience and a safer world.
Thank you, sir. We'll look forward to talking to you again.
Great. All right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Cheers. 9:38 the time. It's the Mornings with Ed Show.